We come to the fifth presentation in the main constellation of 2012. After a Boutonniere floor presentation prelude of the year under the separate title of Our Old Aeon, all the rest of the year, 48 presentations are devoted to the patient unfolding of the petals of a lotus rose, a very rare flower. We need to have a couple of tuning forks, and this is the first one for today. We have talked about for a long time, as Krishnamurti would say, this speaker from this chair has talked about the yoga of civilization, that learning is the yoga of civilization. And we're all familiar with yoga. We need to have another Sanskrit term that pairs with yoga, and that Sanskrit word is yajna. A yajna is a pilgrimage, generally sacred. It is also can be a journey, which is holy. And a yajna sometimes is called a mission, which is diminutive of it. The title of the 2012 main series is Hermetic Bodhisattvas, and in that, the hermetic is the yoga. The bodhisattvas are the yajna. So that if you pair together yoga and yajna, a simple mnemonic way to recall it is that in the universe, which is delimited, and the proof of its delimitation is that numbers work. In infinities, numbers do not work. In zero, numbers do not work. But in the universe, numbers work to any degree of exactitude, of specificity that we wish to have. Our orbiting observatory, the Kepler, keeps track of 150,000 stars at a time. We can have any kind of exactness that we want in the universe through numbers, but we have to be careful because the origins that come out of a zero field and the transformation by consciousness, which emerges out of an infinite field, do not allow us to have a number specificity. Instead, we have to shift to spectrums. We have to shift to sets of resonances that are then coordinated, constellated by harmonics, so that there is such a thing as a very powerful branch of mathematics called harmonic analysis, by which one can go a very long way to understanding that exactitude is complete, but a higher mathematics is able to disclose a perfection beyond completeness. And so what we're looking at here is a yoga and a yajna that involve consciousness. In the universe, the exactness of a pair could be characterized, as it was for 2,200 years in China, as yin and yang. The yin and yang, the yin-yang chia, the school of yin-yang, was founded by Tzu Yan, a Leonardo-type genius in China about 350 BC, about the time of Alexander the Great. The yoga yajna is the complementarity in differential consciousness to yin yang. And in order for the yoga and the yajna to begin to be more than comprehensible, to become what usually in the classic literature of India is called lucidity, the ineffable lucid, one has to have this kind of a complementarity. And the beginnings of a yoga yajna precede yin yang, just like the yin yang chia was preceded by Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, the book of Tao Te. The Tao that can be named is not the Tao. The Te can be named, and it's the Te that is able to be named in a symbolic way as yin yang, so that while there is a yin yang in Te, they are absorbed without leaving a trace in Tao. So that the yoga as a discipline and the yajna as a journey pilgrimage go together to explore. And what they explore is how the universe that does make sense numerically comes out of the mysterious Tao. And it is not only that the Tao is mysterious, but the universe is mysterious because it can be transformed. One can apply further dimensions in a patient yajna, in a patient pilgrimage, and you can have a transformation of the universe by bringing into play a new quality that emerges out of the original field, out of the zero field. And by doing so, the universe now has an element of mysteriousness to it. And what really gets us in this time, March of 2012, is that we're able to understand that there are such things as galactic-wide, for our galaxy, the Milky Way, two big, huge, 25,000 light-year bubbles that curve up from galactic center and curve down from galactic center, so that you get this pairing of balloons, which is a marker for us now that the distortion of distant galaxies by computing through the prismatic indexing of these high energy electron bubbles, one can understand that dark matter occurs. It exists in the universe, but has no light. So one of the expected mathematical genius insights will be that dark matter is space itself. That space has a quality of phenomenality in the universe, does not keep that phenomenality in higher dimensions. Only in a four-dimensional space-time does it have phenomenality. The same for energy. The dark energy is time. And time has a very special quality that is revealed through the prismatic, analytic, and aesthetic of higher dimensions of language. One of the major scientific universities in the world is MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, right next to Harvard. They publish books like The Syntax of Time in Linguistics. One of the reasons for it is that the great founder of linguistics, Roman Jakobson, after he fled his native St. Petersburg because he didn't like the way that the Stalinists were taking over things, became a fabulous professor at Harvard and in association with MIT. And his first really famous graduate student was Noam Chomsky, whose great book was Transformational Grammars. What is interesting is that the blurb on the back of an MIT publication just a few years ago, 21st century, on the syntax of time in language reads that time has no dimensions. And because of this, one is able then to move into a computation that does not involve regular time in the universe at all. This is a confusion. This is the kind of confusion that needs to be combed out, not only for the 21st century, but combed out because it shows that there is a distortion in the symbolic structure of our minds, and that that distortion has been there not forever, but began to occur about 6,000 years ago and became noticeable when human beings became, men and women, became used to patiently refining themselves so that one could notice that the language, the oral spoken language, when it is expressed in writing, when it becomes a written symbolic language, more and more skews to this kind of confusion. It's a confusion because the clarity is based upon a limitation that has boundaries, that has dimensions, and that one assumes that time just simply occurs and space just simply occurs, and that this is nature, and it is indeed nature. But there's more to the cosmos than nature. One of the very first things that one notices about 3000 BC is the questioning of the very foundations of the structure of symbolic thought as the mind. That it needs to have a new set of interpretive ways to understand the mysteriousness of the universe. 3000 BC in Egypt was developed the hieroglyphics, the way in which there is a sacred language that is not just pictographic, but that the pictographic also has a syllabic equivalent, and that one learns to see the pictograph, but to hear the syllabic together, and that this takes a refinement that one cannot settle for a single structure to the symbolic mind, that symbols have a way of reconstellating themselves. And if they can reconstellate themselves, the sense that they make now with the reconstellation is superior to the sense that they were designated before, so that one has the sense for the first time that a transformation from further dimensions raises meaning to a higher level. At the same time in China, 3000 BC, Fuxi and Niu Gua were able to understand that the progression of a very normal, natural cycle can be symbolized in a completely new set of ways based on a primordial retuning. They took a rainstorm in the mountains where there's thunder, then there's the lightning flash of the fire, then there's the rain of the water, then there's the collecting together of the water into pools, into lakes, then there's the wind, etc. And that whole ecology came to be retuned by expressing that the Tao is a space of unknown extent. But the Te has a phenomenal extent that can be symbolized by a line. So one symbolizes Te by a line, one symbolizes Tao by a broken line. And that in order then to have a differential conscious structure, one brings into play what in ritual would be a repetition, in symbols would be a third element brought into play, but in vision it is bringing the mysterious in, because you distribute equally with equanimity, so that the question of a re-identification doesn't arise, the question of saying that this is not an identity doesn't rise, that identity is distributed indefinitely and identification is expanded indefinitely by the simple thing of being able to repeat with a pair of broken and unbroken lines a third line, a thrice greatest symbol. And if you distribute this, if you add a unbroken line to the two pairs, you can have broken on top and unbroken on the bottom. You can have the unbroken on top and the broken on the bottom. If you add to both those pairs an unbroken line, and then to both those pairs a broken line, you get a new set where the new pairedness is an eightfold set. When it's an eightfold set, now you have an opportunity to say that there is a paired progression of the unbroken. There is a paired progression of the broken, and that the progression is that you can have the unbroken on the bottom, in the middle, or on the top. And the same for the unbroken. It can be on the bottom, the middle, or the top. Now one can describe that you can abstract out all three of the unbroken as a set of three unbroken lines, or the same all three broken lines. That constitutes an eight, in Chinese, eight is ba, ba gua, a set of eight symbols. Those eight symbols have a furthering transformational capacity. They not only can re-express nature in its cycle, in its vicissitudes that make up an event, but can also be applied to a relationship of heaven and earth. Earth is a broken, heaven is unbroken. One can express this in terms of the male as a son, the youngest son, the middle son, the eldest son, or the youngest daughter, the middle daughter, the eldest daughter. And abstracting out the maleness, one gets a father. Abstracting out the femaleness, one gets a mother. So that there's a family of three sons and three daughters and a mother and father as a set of eight. And now this becomes a paradigm of the way in which one transforms the natural limits of human beings into a relationship where they are able to function on higher dimensions as a extension of nature, not as a contrast to it. So by 3000 BC, you begin to find that instead of scattered farms, you begin to see eight families cluster together around a central well, and their fields that they tend are like the eightfold petals that come out from the common well, and that this becomes the new paradigm for the way in which villages began to expand, and one can knit together these kinds of eightfold patterns into a new fabric. And eventually, after 2,000 years, after an aeon, one began to understand that this can be expanded almost indefinitely. And by the Zhou dynasty, by about the time of the Trojan War, you got not only the celestial pattern of the I Ching, but you got the familial pattern expanded into the nature of man, men and women as man, mankind. And so you get a different kind of an I Ching, and the classic I Ching that yin-yang was developed out of about 650, 700 years later, its Chinese name is not I Ching so much, it's Zhou Yi. It's the book of the Zhou dynasty, that celebrated itself in a classic called the Song of the Book of Songs, that one now understood that there is an amazing capacity for human beings in their male-female complementarity, in their further dimensional qualities, that one can write not only in a new higher dimensional poetic, but one can analyze in a higher dimension as well, so that the aesthetic and the analytic both come out together into play, the aesthetic from a visionary field, the analytic from a historical complex, where experience in nature is generally what used to be called a horizon, the stream of experience, the river of what happens on a ritual base leading to symbolic integrals. But history is complex. It creates a kaleidoscopic experience that is amenable to experiment. But not only amenable just to experiment, but able to bring out of vision, out of a theoria, to bring a theory out of vision, to project it through the prismatic person into a spectrum, which then one can keep track of in a complex history. And out of this comes the refinement of the refinement, a second transformation. It comes out as a distillation of the first transformation. Whatever you were able to transform through a fermentation before, instead of just having the rain as water, one had the ability to make a wine. And now one has the ability to distill the cognac, to distill the champagne. One had the ability to ferment the wild grains and to increase them from 8 corns per stalk through a couple of transforms to double it to 16 and then double that to bread wheat, which is 32 corns. And now one has the capacity not only to just get by in nature or to do better in a initial transform of nature, but to do superiorly in a third level, so that always the thrice greatest is the distillation to excellence. Not just getting by, not just good, but excellent. And it's that excellence that comes through in a pair of books. One of them was written in China, at first in India, and then taken to China. The other came out of Alexandria, and they were both composed about the same time, in the space between 90 and 100 AD. The Western was called the Faith Wisdom Book, Pistis Sophia. The India-China one was called the Mahayana Shraddhapada Shastra, the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. Both concerned faith, at the same time, seemingly worlds apart. But something further occurred. The Pistis Sophia centered in an Alexandrian quality of a complex dialogue based on being able to recite Psalms of David and then being able to interpret those songs of David. And then a third level of being able to go into a distillation of that whole technique and to be able to take something further from the Psalms of David, the Odes of Solomon, and to be able then to interpret the Odes of Solomon in a higher dimension, raising the interpretive quality. The word in Greek for interpretation is hermeneutic, based on Hermes. The hermeneutic becomes refined enough to be very good, and then it becomes refined of the refinement to become excellent. And in the excellence, the inevitable person who arrives in the Pistis Sophia to make poignant third level superior inquiries, no longer questions, but inquiries, not questions seeking an answer, but inquiries looking for illumination of that will light the way. If you get answers to questions, you can keep on the path. As Richard Feynman classically termed it, the path integral. So if you learn to ask questions and to seek answers, that's good. But it doesn't illumine the way. The way is something different. If you keep on the path, you classically, like in the tarot card of the hermit card, you hold a lantern and you carry a staff. And this is the way that you are able to keep on the path. But if you go to the distillation, instead of having a lantern with a staff, one now has a hermetic caduceus with winged feet and winged helmet, and able then to pull someone out of the natural containment hole in which they were, not to put them on a track of a path, but to bring them out into the freedom of not just a landscape, but a cosmic scape. This is the way in which a hermetic yoga enlightens at a thrice greatest level. And in a complement to it, the thrice greatest yajna becomes something that is equally colossal. The bodhisattva's way is a cosmic yajna. The hermetic yoga is a cosmic wisdom. They both occurred at the same time, with this caveat, that while the Far East got its yajna and the middle pivot got its yoga, the balance of the Far East was the Far West. And in the Far West, there was an unexpected tragedy that fractured what would have carried the family heritage indefinitely into active play. The family heritage was cut off. And next week we'll see that that family heritage that was cut off in the fourth generation. And the casualty from that was that the central synthesizing symbol that had become transparent for the transformation, that could have been refined then for the distillation, was lost. And what was lost was the crater, the Holy Grail, the cup of the Last Supper that went to the Far West. And we've talked about this a number of times, and next week we'll comb it through again so that you can appreciate that this Far West, Far East pivotal spectrum of a wisdom that had become refined to the extent to be able to be literally unlimited in its capacity was suddenly hamstrung. It was crippled, so that the farther east became glorious, the pivot became problematic, and the far west became tragic instead of heroic. And in this imbalance lays the problem of civilization ever since. The last 2,000 years have seen a crippled humanity, only able to limp along, and occasionally in pockets of men and women, to have that thrice greatest gorgeousness, which would never really last because there was always this sense of a lurking imbalance, a lurking tragedy. And what we're doing here is we're trying to patiently refine and comb out and not deliver it as fait accompli plan, but to disclose the way in which a sensitivity that deepens and is able to become dimensional will finally allow us to understand that we do not have to stop with a tragedy, because one can reinterpret the original tragedy into an opportunity. And the opportunity of that, the initial opportunity of that, the initial vision The theory of that opportunity came in the 1100s AD with the realization that just because the Grail is lost does not mean that you cannot search for it, that you cannot take up a yajna to find it. And when you take up a yajna to find it, even the searching itself can stand for the Grail, can allow for the emergence of that refinement. And we'll see next week. I brought the book last week, The Crater and the Grail. The crater from the way in which the central cup of the Last Supper was transformed into a hermetic vessel of inner transformation. It wasn't about food. It wasn't about drink. It wasn't about their stand-ins in terms of symbolic valuation. Rather, it was facets like a jewel of being able to understand that there is a tremendous relationship that is only discoverable when you have the full spectrum. If you go from Ireland to India, and you go into the north of India, which is crossing into Tibet, one finds 1,000 years later that people began to notice that the higher folklore of Ireland and the higher Dharma of Tibet were related together. And the first person to write a book on that was W.Y. Evans Wentz. After the fairy faith in the Celtic countries, he went to Tibet and found a Lama, Lama Kazi Dawa Samdub, who helped him to write 4 classics on the Vajrayana, starting with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, all published by Oxford University Press. Evans Wentz was an American. He lived in San Diego, and with the proceeds of his books, he bought a sacred mountain called Cuchama on the border of Mexico and California, where one could have a deep vision. Let's take a break. Let's come back to the sound of construction outside. After all, it is Los Angeles. If you put 2 cubed, which is 8, into a set, that set is able to be doubled so that you get 8 times 8. Which gives you 64. And a complex set of 64 is not only the hexagrams of the I Ching, of the Zhou-Yi, but is also the triple codons of DNA and many other sets. And one doesn't have to go beyond that. You can, but that's sufficient to do an analytic on almost every conceivable level, except for dimensions that go beyond 9. You cannot go beyond 8 dimensions that can come together to make a combined, ratioed, proportioned 9th. You cannot go to a 10th dimension without a 3rd kind of transformation. That 3rd transformation is a peculiar transformation, to say the least. In the Hermetica, one of the most poignant of all of the Hermetica dialogues was called The 8th Reveals the 9th. And it was excised from the classic Hermetica in the early 3rd century and the early 200s AD by a royal tyrannical pair, the Roman Emperor Septimius Severus and his very bossy wife, who was about 6 inches taller than him, Julia Domna. And she and her sister literally ran the emperor and the Roman Empire. But the Severan couple went around to all of the esoteric libraries, including that in Alexandria, and excised all of the esoteric, really esoteric books, so that no one would have access to them except themselves. This was in the 200s, early 200s AD. And one way to index their capacities is that their son that took over, Julia Domna's oldest son, was named Caracalla for the big Roman overcoat. And he was one of the craziest tyrannical Roman emperors of all time. He built not temples, but he built the baths of Caracalla, which was larger than temples, so that you could go and you could have almost an indefinite number of massages and encounters, etc. And it was like a coliseum of sybaritic pleasures. The Hermetica that was excised, the 8th reveals the 9th, was preserved as a lot of the sacred books of the world are preserved by rare individuals that not only keep them, but when they begin to fray, to make copies of them. And when the Nag Hammadi material was found in 1945, in a bend of the Nile River, where there was an ancient monastery where everything had to be buried again because there was another episode of tyranny, of being executed. And in the 13 leather-bound little books, one of them had the 8th reveals the 9th and was translated in Seaside, California by Lewis Kaiser, and I have a rare copy of that. It was hardly ever for sale anywhere. What's interesting is that in the 8th reveals the 9th, right at the end of the dialogue, Hermes Trismegistus is talking with his son, philosophic son, Tot, and he says, when you get to the 9th, you are able to hear singing in the 10th. And that, as you can tell, it's not singing for us. We can close that window.
It is closed.
The window is closed. So you can understand that it takes a yoga to be able to stay with us and a yajna to continue to stay with us. Right.
So there's major interruption going on tonight.
Yes. What you hear in the 10th is a choir of cosmic proportions singing in hyperspace. At the end of the 1100s into the 1200s, you had the beginnings of what was a proto-Renaissance. In the 1100s, by the 1130s in England, there were only 3 places in all of England that women could go to in a convent-style retreat. 30 years later, there were almost 70, because there was an explosion of the capacity of women to have a spiritual dimension in their lives as a community and not be assigned as property, as spoken for. And one found at the same time that the women began to understand that spiritual hymning was a capacity of personal prismatic perception, and the woman who led that entire development was Hildegard of Bingen, born in the 1090s. She lived to be almost 80 years of age. Not only did she compose her fabulous hymns, but she set them to her own music. She was the greatest composer of that age. And one can now, on CDs, hear the great, huge constellations of all of her songs and hymns together. And next week, I will bring a whole stack of materials on Hildegard of Bingen. She had one intellectual peer at the time. His name was Bernard of Clairvaux. And Bernard of Clairvaux was the one who spoke not just of spiritual things, but he's the one who founded the deep rationale for stepping up the early crusade into a huge military crusade that went on for centuries. When you look at the works of Bernard of Clairvaux, the largest collection are 5 volumes of commentary on the Song of Songs, because Hildegard of Bingen kept teasing out of him the understanding that the capacity of really genius spiritual women comes through their ability to write some of the highest spiritual poetry. And that as the Song of Songs, she maintained that it was written by a woman, not by Solomon, but by a woman who was close to Solomon, who worked his language, his kind of poems, into her brilliant language, her brilliant poems, and that woman was the Queen of Sheba from Ethiopia, who was extraordinary, who went to Solomon to hear his wisdom, as one would test gold ore to see what the quality of the gold would come out of the gold ore. And the gold that came out of that gold ore, their relationship was not only the Song of Songs, but was an impregnation that resulted later in a son. His name was Menelik. And Menelik, when he was 21, left Ethiopia, went to Jerusalem, went to the temple. I hope you can hear this through the interference. He's the one who saw that the old Solomon was surrounded by sycophants, that he had failed. He had succeeded to build the temple, succeeded in his own personal wisdom, succeeded with his mother, succeeded gloriously in many ways, but he was unable to resonate out. And so Menelik went not only to the temple, but the Holy of Holies, and he stole the Holy Ark of the Covenant. He reclaimed it from this desecration of capacity. And when Solomon died, within a couple of years, the kingdom split into two and has remained two ever since. One part was Palestine, the other part was Judea, Israel. It was turned into a Palestine around Samaria. The other was centered on Jerusalem and Judea. And you still have the PLO and the Israelis split today from that split. And as we showed last week, the Ark of the Covenant is still in Ethiopia, where it was placed by Menelik, in Aksum. And when Christianity was introduced early on into Ethiopia, a special cross church was cut into solid living rock huge, enormous. I brought an illustration of it last week. I'll bring it again. The introduction of Christianity to refine the Solomonic Judaism was initiated by the second great queen of Ethiopia. Her name was Candace. And Candace, like the Queen of Sheba, 1,000 years before her, sent regular caravans to trade along the Mediterranean coast and to bring down the Red Sea to Ethiopia the trade that was going on. Ethiopia was the center of gathering the frankincense and myrrh and all of the things from Arabia, trade with India, the African things, sending them to the Mediterranean world and bringing back other things. The head of the trade caravan of the moment came just a week or so after the crucifixion resurrection, and the apostle Philip was walking and received an instant calling to go and talk to this important caravan leader in his chariot, and he noticed that he was reading the Old Testament in Hebrew. And he said to him, "Do you know what you're reading?" And they got into a conversation, and Philip said, "There is something further that has just happened." And in the conversation, the caravan head said, "Is there any way that I can be baptized now? Look, there's a oasis pool right there." And so Philip baptized him and gave him information, which he took back to Ethiopia to Queen Candace, who was then ready. And about a generation later, when Thomas was on his way to India, usually apostles would pair up and travel together. The apostle that traveled with St. Thomas down the Red Sea was the apostle Matthew. And Matthew is the one who then took the refinement of Solomon, the Jesus of the Gospel of Matthew, to Ethiopia. And what he took with him was a copy of the Gospel according to Thomas, which he had just finished, a copy of his own gospel, which he had just finished, and a copy, a rare copy, of the sacred, secret part of the book of Enoch, which is the second vision of Enoch, the three parables about the Son of Man, so that when the book of Enoch was rediscovered in the 1700s in Ethiopia, it had all five books of the book of Enoch. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, there were only four. The fifth book was only written about the beginnings of the AD. And as we're saying here, it was written by the earthly father of Jesus, by Joseph, to convey to him in his study for his bar mitzvah coming up at 13, where he left at age 12, not just left Jerusalem, but left the Palestine of the day and was taken back to Alexandria, where he was to do his study for his bar mitzvah. And this was his father's contribution, the parables about the Son of Man, so that Jesus had bone deep the understanding of dimensional layers of cosmic capability for him, which then could be carried out, not limited to himself like Solomon, but able to carry it out. The quality comes out in one of the Odes of Solomon, This is Ode 14. It's written by a woman, as you can well tell. It's written by Mary Magdalene. As the eyes of a son upon his father, so are my eyes, O Lord, at all times toward thee, because my breasts and my pleasure are with thee. Turn not aside thy mercies from me, O Lord, and take not thy kindness from me. Stretch out to me, my Lord, at all times the right hand, and be to me a guide till the end according to thy will. Let me be pleasing before thee because of thy glory, and because of thy name, let me be saved from the evil one. And let thy greatness, O Lord, abide with me, and the fruits of thy love. Teach me the odes of thy truth, that I may produce fruits in thee. And open to me the harp of the Holy Spirit, so that with every note I may praise thee, O Lord. And according to the multitude of thy mercies, so grant unto me. And hasten to grant our petitions, for thou art sufficient for all our needs. Hallelujah. This quality of Mary Magdalene, when it passed into India with St. Thomas, took a very special kind of refinement with it. At the end of the Gospel according to Thomas, and the Gospel according to Thomas is a series of sayings, the sayings of the living Jesus. Thomas, Matthew, and Philip were the three apostles, like the three legs of a stool, like the three supports of a tripod, to listen with the ears to be able to hear exactly and precisely so that one could write down what one could still hear. It takes a very special quality of remembering to be able to do this. You cannot do it depending upon memory. There's a limit to what a memory can hold. But remembering is in an infinite field and has no limit whatsoever. And when it has no limit whatsoever, the remembering, when it is fertilized by what in the mind was a structure, in the symbolic mind, the imagination is a structure like the memory, and it's limited. But in the exchange where remembering became the memory, the imagination became creative imagining, which again, like remembering, is without limit. And it's an interesting thing that when you have remembering and creative imagining, what spontaneously comes out is art. And the pivot of art is the artist. And the pivot of the pivot, the distilling of the pivot of the artist, is the spiritual person. And that spiritual person is like a well-cut gem, like a jewel, that has the ability to have as many facets as they are putting into it, and does not destroy, does not fracture, does not distort the gem, so that in the Mahayana, at the center of its great history, about 850 AD, one of the most powerful Mahayana sutras is called the Diamond Sutra. In fact, it's called the Vajracchedika Sutra. In Sanskrit, sutra means thread. When monks used to chant together in the old Theravada, Tara means elders, Vada means path. And the old path of the elders, they would hold a gold thread and they would chant the sutras together with that gold thread. But in the Mahayana, it wasn't holding a gold thread on the path, it was being facets of the jewel matrix in an infinite cosmos. And so the Vajracchedika, the Diamond Cutter Sutra, is based on something about 900 years before, because the first person to ever use the term of being able to cut the spiritual person by language was Philo of Alexandria. And he used the term the Logos Cutter, because he heard someone who was the Logos Cutter in Alexandria. He heard the way that the living young Jesus not just talked, but penetrated through listening. And he says in The Contemplative Life, one of his surviving treatises, that the president of the healers community could speak so that his words became engraved on the insides of the minds of those listening, so that his speaking wrote the language on the inner part of the membrane of the mind, so that when one not only heard it, but the writing made these kinds of written language perforations, like ionic channels through the membrane of a cell, so that one then could get the nourishment from without in and the nourishment from within out. And so you had the ability to have communities where they were able to communicate not only with themselves and with each other, but in terms of a cosmic infinite field. This is a different scale of dimensions. And it is on that scale that a 10-dimensional hyperspace has an added quality to it. It has an 11th dimension of fertility, which is able to infuse that fertility into the zero field of nature, so that spontaneously what can come out will be real. We'll have a time dimension, which instantly engenders the three dimensions of space, so that you get a four-dimensional space-time spontaneously, then instantly, which is able to last as a universe. And if the universe has these ionic channels of spiritual persons, the universe can communicate on all the dimensions of the cosmos. And so life becomes capable of eternal life. This is the last saying in the Gospel of Thomas. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary go from us, from among us, because women are not worthy of the life." Now, this quality of Simon Peter was not just because he was ostensibly, pardon the phrase, like a truck driver, but he had married the daughter of a very powerful man. And she had died young, so that her mother stayed on to run the rather big house of Simon Peter. It's been reconstructed, and if you go to Capernaum, you will find the house of Simon Peter, a tourist attraction. It's right next to the synagogue of Capernaum, which is a tourist attraction. The keeper of his house was his mother-in-law. And his mother-in-law was the daughter of Aristobulus. And Aristobulus was the middle son of three sons. The oldest son was named Alphaeus because he was the first. Aristobulus was the middle son, and the final son was Zebedee, from A to Z. The father of these three was also named Zebedee, but the grandfather of those three was named John. That's how John went in the family, because when Zebedee had sons, he named one James and one John. And his wife was the oldest sister of Jesus, Salome, who was born in Alexandria. So that, in a peculiar way, the sons of Alphaeus were cousins to the sons of Zebedee, and the two sons of Alphaeus were the man that we call Matthew, which is an appellation Jesus gave him, meaning grace of God. His given name was Levi, Levi bar Alphaeus. And when you read the Gospel of Mark, he calls him Levi bar Alphaeus because he was only 10 years old at the crucifixion, resurrection, and he didn't know any of these relations very well. He didn't call him Matthew. And Matthew, as the son of Alphaeus, had a brother also named James because it ran in the family. And both Matthew and James, the lesser, were apostles of Jesus, just like James and John were apostles. They were brothers and brothers, just like Peter and Andrew, brothers together. So that you, when you look at the constellation of the 12 apostles, you get six pairs. You get the three pairs of brothers, but you get a pair because Philip and Nathanael were very close together, and Thomas and Thaddeus were very close together. They were both from what is today Syria. They were both from the Damascus area. So that when a king of Armenia named Abgar, actually Abgar the VII, wrote to Jesus to have someone sent from him to teach us the word after the resurrection, it was Thomas who took Thaddeus into Armenia. And you don't find in modern references very much on Thaddeus. I'll bring a volume from about 100, 125 years ago, a big four-volume set. And there's about 15 pages on Thaddeus. That's how the legend of Thomas going to Armenia began. But then Thomas came back and was there until 41 AD when he went off to India. Here is the reply to Simon Peter by Jesus that ends the gospel according to Thomas. Jesus said, "See, I shall lead her, so that I will make her male, that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Meaning not male as in male versus female, but meaning man as in son of man can remake man into a better man. And when that better man distills, you get an eternal man. The quality that Thomas took with him was masterful in its strategy. In the northern part of India, what is today Kashmir and Pakistan, that area was filled since Alexander the Great with Greek kings. And those Greco-Buddhist kings were always interested in finding, as Greeks would be, what the best truth was, and to have questions answered about these kinds of things. And in the classic Pali Canon, there's a very large tome called The Questions of King Milinda. Milinda is the way Pali is a southern accent, Magadhi Sanskrit. They speak with a southern accent. And Menander was asking of Nagasena, a very wonderful monk, various questions, and Nagasena was replying. And this is about 100 BC. Later on, the king of that area's name was Gandhafares. And Gandhafares was a very interesting character. He was not only the king of this vast Gandhara, as it was called at that time, but he was in contact with Alexandria, and through his contacts, heard of Jesus, heard that Jesus was from an architectural family. Joseph was not just a carpenter. He could build anything. Thomas also was an architect. And so Jesus, in reply to Gandhafares, to send him an architect to build a royal wisdom palace, Thomas went to India. But he didn't go overland to the Kashmiri Gandhara north. He took the ancient Semitic sea route down the Red Sea to Socotra, the island at the mouth of the Red Sea, from whence one with the monsoon winds could sail in about a week's time to southern India. And that southern India was the ancient Semitic trading post for spices like cinnamon or pepper and many other aspects, and then took shipping up the coast of India into the Indus River area up into Kashmir. So he dealt with Gandhafares, and instead of building him a physical temple, he gave all of the money away to the people. And when Gandhafares came back from conquest and found that there was no temple, that the coffers were empty, he put Thomas into prison. Until he realized that he was the most beloved emperor in history, that all of the people were for him, praying for him, and that his temple had been built out of refined spiritual persons, he let Thomas go. And Thomas went back to southern India and left the Malabar coast and went across the tip, the peninsula of India, and went to the Bay of Bengal on the other coast, midway between the Malabar landing place and where Madras is, now it's called Chennai. About midway, there is a city called Salem, like Jerusalem, like Salem, Massachusetts. Salem, Tamil state, means peace in Hebrew. Next week, we'll talk a little more about the peculiar quality of the way in which Thomas, as a masterful spiritual architect, brought the southern Mahayana yoga up the coast of the Bay of Bengal, India, to the spot where Calcutta is today. And there, a young Brahmin named Asvaghosha was able to convert from being a Brahmin to being a Mahayana, a great way Bodhisattva. And he was invited by the current king then of Gandhara, whose name was Kanishka. And Kanishka, on one of his gold coins, is painted like this. And if you look at the hermit card in the tarot deck, you will see The resonance still holds. He still has the lantern, he still has the staff, and he has the conical hood in the shape of like a lunar Hermes, who invited Ashvaghosha to spread the Mahayana through his kingdoms, which by then ran all the way through the Gobi Desert into the Tokara area bordering Russia today. More next week.